My name is Noreen Tomasi. I'm the director of the Center for Fiction, and I'd like to welcome you all to this event. So, tonight we're at the dark end of the street, and it is my pleasure to introduce two wonderful writers that I consider friends of the center, and to thank Bloomsbury for all they did to organize this wonderful event, including the reception beforehand, and also to welcome our friends from Yaddo. So without further ado then, I think I have all my thank yous in order, and all your cell phones are off, yes? Okay, here are S.J. Roseanne and Jonathan Santlover.
So, over a year ago, S.J. and I were in Grand Central Station having something to eat, and we had just come from a talk about why or how crime fiction was a denigrated genre.
And you know, we don't approve of that denigration, and we thought, wouldn't it be great if we could do a book where half the writers were crime fiction writers and the other half were literary fiction writers, and the book would be really a substantial and quite good book. And that was, you know, I talk like that all the time. Wouldn't that be nice? And, you know, but I was talking to Jonathan.
I don't know what that means. what it meant essentially was that we then actually put it to the test and we asked writers. And the amazing thing is that almost every writer we asked said yes, and said enthusiastically, yes. I remember, I'm looking at the writers now, and I remember Francine Prose saying, not just another boring anthology. And Amy Hempel said, how great, Lee Child's one of my favorite writers. So it was kind of like this amazing synergy that happened in a very, very, sort of a quick amount of time, right?
It got to be a sort of, you know, let's put on a show, I have costumes in the barn. And we kept saying, well, let's take it to the next step. Okay, we have all these writers. You know, let's see if we can, you know, get a good list. Let's see if we can, you know, get stories. Let's see if we can sell the booklet. And every step we took it to, it actually went to. Until finally, you know, we have this fabulous book, which if you haven't bought it yet, you know, it's for sale in the back and downstairs, apparently. And it's really good.
I like this little routine we have here. One of the great, and we'll make this really fast, great things about doing this was that every couple of weeks another story appeared from one of the writers, and it was so exciting, and SJ and I would call each other, and we would talk about, did you see Michael Connelly's story? Did you see Ed White's story? Did you see Madison Bell's story? And it was really, really fun for us. Of course, we totally edited and rewrote all the stories ourselves, but no, we didn't do any of that at all. The collection really far exceeded our wildest expectation, and it really, we think, shows that a story is a story is a story.
Yeah, it succeeded in doing what we wanted to do, which is if you don't know how the writers are classified on the bookshelves of bookstores, you don't know who is a crime writer and who is a literary writer, because these are such good stories. They're just really terrific. So what's going to happen is that the writers will get up and have 2 minutes to read, talk about their story, sing, dance, whatever it is you all want to do. So we do this alphabetically because Jonathan and I don't have much imagination. And we're going to start with Madison Smart Bell.
Thank you all. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to ask you not to look at my thumb. Please don't look at my thumb. I'm embarrassed about it. I cut it on a piece of chocolate. I'm just going to read a little bit from the story of mine that's in the anthology, and one of the noir elements in this story is the death of print journalism, so you can savor that as you go. At 42nd Street, he got the A train. The rush hour scrum had already thinned enough. There was breathing room. By the time the train had left Manhattan, he had no trouble finding himself a seat. A wing of newsprint drifted across the floor, stirred by the scissoring legs of a descending passenger. The journalist leaned to catch it up, glanced at the top headline,
try to live in this town on 500K. I know you all remember that one. Smirking in the shadow of his hood, he rolled the paper and slapped it on his knee. Half drowsing, as the train dragged from stop to stop through Brooklyn, he recalled the panhandler who'd accosted him that morning when he'd set his satchel down for a moment on the sidewalk just outside Penn Station. I should say at this point that Jonathan pointed out to me once I turned in my story that this was supposed to be about both sex and crime, and I didn't have a whole lot of sex in my story, and could I do anything about that? And I said, yes, I'll take it under consideration anyway. This is all the sex there is. The man had cashed a couple of dollars. The journalist gave up the money for luck, then described, apropos of nothing, but with a peculiar shuddering relish, an event of fellatio he had once experienced. Was the story in exchange for the dollars? The journalist wondered. If so, he didn't think he wanted it. He took a couple of steps away, but the panhandler closed the distance, softly saying, it's nicer to ask. I don't like to rob people. Not until much later in the day had the journalist processed the statement as a threat. At the time, he had not felt menaced in the least. You're a good man, the panhandler said. I see it in your eyes. The journalist must have cocked an eyebrow above the aviator sunglasses he wore, for the panhandler then added, I see your eyes outside your glasses. The subway lurched around an underground bend, and the journalist came half awake for an instant, unsure where he was, clinging to a rail of a truck or the strap of a bus, rounding hairpins in the highlands of Rwanda, maybe in the mountains of Jamaica, where he had once gone to report on a 200-year-old community of Maroons. He opened his eyes completely. The vodka was draining out of his system, leaving behind it little claw marks of despair. He was riding an empty car with only his reflection, leather jacket and face in shadow under the hood, accompanying him from the window across the way. The journalist checked his phone, his knife, his keys, the slack black bag on the seat behind him. He closed his eyes. There's a little bit of exposition, which I'm going to skip. And then he wakes up. He came fully awake again as the train began to traverse Jamaica Bay. On the north shore, a jetliner lowered toward the tarmac. The journalist felt his belly tighten, then released when it safely touched down. A few years previously, he'd been one of a pack rushing out to cover the plane that had flamed out and flown straight to the bottom of the dark water he was studying now. Or no, it was only the tail cone that had landed in the bay while the rest of the plane slammed into shore to raise a dozen houses and kill all aboard, 9 crew, 241 paying passengers, 5 lap children. The journalist remembered these statistics plainly. He had a convenient faculty for that sort of thing. 245 disparate tales hurled forward to the same rough jolt of an ending. He went on, peering out the window into the water below the filament of track. There were glints reflected from chunks of ice floating in the chop raised by the wind. Who's up next?
Thank you, Madison.
I don't have the list, but I can guess. Lee Child.
Thank you. My career is based on complete randomness and arbitrary choices, so I said yes to this anthology for 2 very small reasons. The first very small reason is S.J. Roseanne, who
I'm right next to
you. Yeah, right. She is, in fact, my long-lost separated-at-birth twin sister. We figured that out some years ago. But also, she wrote a book called Absent Friends, and I think when you write a book that good, then I say yes to you the rest of your life. The other small reason that I did this is because there has been a thing on my mind for 44 years, and I finally figured out a way that I could put it down on paper and maybe it would stop being on my mind. And so this is the thing that's been on my mind, something that I'm confronted with at least once a day and have been for the last 44 years. And so my main character in the story wakes up and he needs a cigarette, so he looks across the room and he sees a pack. But I am disappointed. Not a fresh pack, an almost fresh pack. A pack, in fact, in the condition I like least, recently unwrapped, the crisp little cardboard lid raised up, and one cigarette missing from the front row. I hate that for two reasons. First, the pack looks violated, like a dear, dear friend with a front tooth punched out. Ugly. And second, however hard I try to prevent it, the sight sends me spiraling back to grade school arithmetic. There are 20 cigarettes in a new pack, arranged in three rows, and 20 is not fucking divisible by three. I see a pack like that, and I'm instantly full of rage and paranoia. The tobacco companies are lying to me. Which, of course, they would. They have an accomplished track record in that department. For 40 years, I've been paying for 20, and all along they have been supplying me with 18. 18 is divisible by 3, as is 21, but are you seriously suggesting that tobacco companies would supply more than a person pays for?
Thank you, Lee. That was great. Like everybody in the collection, Michael Connelly needs no introduction. Michael.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you for having me. Thanks for asking me. And actually editing. I don't do a lot of short stories, but almost never do they get sent back to me for improvements. And these guys actually did that. And I also wanted to mention the illustrations, wonderful illustrations by Jonathan. Check those out in the book. Like I said, I don't do a lot of short stories. For the most part, I write novels. And when you write a novel, you cast a big net. And what's cool about a collection like this, or being asked to add to the collection, you can, something that you didn't use, you can then find a place for. And that was why I said yes to this request. A few years ago, I started writing books about a criminal defense attorney, and I'm not an attorney myself, so to do those books, I knew I had to spend time with some attorneys, observe attorneys, to try to figure out how they think and so forth. So I did almost all the research for these books, not in the courthouse, but in a bar. I was told early on that if I really wanted to get that kind of information, you should go to this place in Tampa, Florida, where I live, called Four Green Fields, about 4:30. Because the courtrooms close around 4, they go dark around 4, and by 4:30 there are people there getting martinis, and almost all of them are lawyers. The bar is actually owned by a prosecutor. And so that's where I did the research for these books, and if I put a credit card down and bought people drinks, I got lots of anecdotal stories, and they're all wonderful stories, or most of them are wonderful stories, but they didn't all fit in my book. Or books. And what I did here was take one of those stories and turn it into a short story. I'm not going to read from it. I'll just tell you it's about an attorney came up to me in this bar and said, let me tell you about this case where I defended a stripper who had been arrested on the beach for a nude sunbathing. And I got her off completely, and this is how I did it. And so I took that and turned it into this story. And like I said, it was a story, I wanted to say it's based on a true story, or it is a true story, but it was told to me in a bar, so I think it qualifies for the Center for Fiction. Thanks a lot.
Lee, thank you for that lovely, I don't know what to say. James Grady, who is one of my first friends in this business and one of my best.
That makes me a lucky man indeed. I'd like to use my 2 minutes to say thank you to absolutely everyone for absolutely everything. But especially I'd like to thank all my fellow contributors to this anthology, because without you, I wouldn't get to be here. And this is an extraordinarily impressive posse in which I get a chance to ride. I thought the best way to show how I got lucky enough to end up here was to read the opening of my short story. The short story is entitled Midnight Stockings. The title Stockings is spelled S-T-A-L-K-I-N-S, but perhaps a slightly different interpretation will begin to emerge as I read. Erin wore a stolen maid's uniform as she walked up the grand staircase from the Manhattan mansion's first floor party preparations. She carried a stack of white towels as if they hid nothing. Kept her thighs from brushing together and breaking the glass tubes of acid tucked into her garter-belted midnight stockings. Forget acid. She worried someone might discover she wore no panties. Not my style. But when she'd stood in her Brooklyn one-room walk-up and used her lone window to the night as a mirror, that dark glass reflection of her social worker's white underpants over the black garter belt and stockings made her look like a joke. She refused any such role. Better to be bold than to be a buffoon. Her borrowed black high heel climbed another step in the mansion. Just this once, and I'm free. Erin reached the third floor landing, where firelight flickered beyond the study's open sliding doors. He deserves it. Cowgirl hips swayed her maid's skirt. Floating up from downstairs came a radio voice turned on by the caterer to track time. This is the most exciting cultural moment of 1939. We shall now broadcast live our opera selections timed to end precisely at midnight. A closed downstairs door muffled the radio. A clock went gong 11 times as she entered the study. A flat oak desk ruled that room. Wall sconces and the fireplace blazing behind the desk created undulating waves of golden light and warm shadows. A crystal vase held blossoming red roses. Above the mantel hung a painting of dogs playing poker. Erin stacked the white towels on the otherwise bare desk, rolled the double doors shut, leaned her back against them with her wrists crossed behind her as if they were handcuffed. You can still change your mind. Run. But she didn't. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim Grady. Some of you might remember, I remember reading 6 Days of the Condor, one of my favorite books, and I also liked the movie 3 Days of the Condor, which I never quite understood what happened to those other 3 days. But, you know, that's what happens. When I asked Amy Hempel to write the story, she was very nervous about writing a crime story, and she did an amazing, amazing job. Thank you, Amy. Come up, please.
Thanks again for asking. I think I was the last person to turn mine in, wasn't I? I was. I know I was. I know I was. Slow. Okay. A few years ago, I'll just read to the very beginning of my very short story. But a few years ago, I went back to school. I went to John Jay College of Criminal Justice. I enrolled in a degree program in forensic psychology. And what I really, it was funny, I always thought, well, why do some people cross that line and do things that others of us, including myself, don't? And I came out of there wondering why we're not all doing it all the time. Because God knows there's plenty of reasons. So here's just the very beginning of greed. Mrs. Greed had been married for 40 years, her husband the cuckold of all time. A homely man with a notable fortune, he escorted her on errands in the neighborhood. It was a point of honor with Mrs. Greed to say she would never leave him, no matter if her affection for him was surpassed by her devotion to others, including, for example, my husband. If she was home at night in her husband's bed, did he care what she did with her days? I was the one who cared. Protected by men, money, and a lack of shame, Mrs. Greed had long been able to avoid what she had coming. She had the kind of glee that meant men did not think she slept around. They thought she had joie de vivre. They thought her a libertine, not a whore. She had the means to indulge impetuous behavior and sleep through the mornings after nights she kept secret from her friends. She traveled the world and turned into the person she could be in other places with people she would never see again. She was many years older than my husband, running on the fumes of her beauty. Hers had been a conventional beauty, and I was embarrassed by my husband's homage to it. Running through their rendezvous, a stream of regret that they had not met sooner. Thank you.
And now, straight from Baltimore, or New Orleans, the wondrous Laura Lippman.
I'm not going to read, in part because I learned to read with phonics, which as a result I have a very large vocabulary, most of which I can't pronounce. Whenever I get up to read one of my stories, I come to a word I don't actually know how to say. This is how I write short stories. I get an email and someone says, will you write a short story about blank? And by that time in my writing year, I'm usually ready for a diversion from the novel. So that way I've written about cocaine and golf and jazz and... S.J. wrote and asked me to write about sex and crime, and I thought that's actually one of the easier ones I've been asked to do. When you write short stories this way, you don't really know what sort of themes are emerging in your work. About 2 years ago, all the short stories I wrote to date were gathered in one collection, and my husband began reading it, and he began getting very, very nervous, because it turns out every short story I write is about something really horrible that goes wrong between usually a married couple. And I'm really proud to say that the story in this collection, Tricks, keeps the streak alive. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura. Laura's story is a wonderful story about being careful about who you might want to marry, correct? In any case, I want to say that in introducing Francine Prose, I have a very, very strong memory of I don't know what time of year it was, but I was on a. I had read Coetzee's Disgrace, Philip Roth's The Dying Animal, two books about middle-aged men making fools of themselves with young women, and I was at an art colony as a visiting artist. All the women were like 16. And then I started reading Francine Prose's Blue Angel. Now, if you haven't read that book, it's a fantastic book. But it's the same theme of a middle-aged man making a fool of himself. And so that was the... I was totally well-behaved.
Gee, that's why I wrote Blue Angel, Jonathan. I thought if I can stop one more of those from happening. Well, like all of you, I learned everything I know about sex and crime from Law and Order, SVU. And among the things I learned from the good detectives, especially Ice-T, was how much wider the range of sexual obsession and perversion was than I'd ever imagined. Hence my story. I'm going to read one page called The Beheading. As a child, I was fascinated by decapitation. Not what we think of now, grainy terrorist videos or Hong Kong sword fight films or serial killers with trophies grinning in the freezer. and not by every beheading, but only certain ones. The Virgin Martyrs left me cold, as did John the Baptist, though the volume of the Lives of the Saints on our otherwise sparse suburban bookshelf featured an illustration of a luscious Salome with the Baptist's head on the platter. Marie Antoinette held me for a while, but finally what drew me were the legal executions with which kings got rid of their wives. I was obsessed with the history of the court of King Henry VIII. I read through the school and library books and asked my parents for more. It was how I learned about sex, that is, something beyond the basics. What other reason could there have been for a man to tire of one woman and divorce her if he could, or kill her if he couldn't, and when the divorces got to be too much trouble? Why else would he keep burying his dead wife's ladies-in-waiting, and what charges convinced a judge to decapitate them so cruelly? Had the women really fallen in love with the handsome young nobles? This was nothing I could have learned at home, where my religious parents stayed lukewarmly married until they died months apart. Like only children everywhere, I got a partial education, isolated by turns removed and unhealthily attentive. I used to imagine the moment when the head is severed from the body. What were head and body, one without the other? Where did the person go? Was there such a thing as a soul, and where did it reside? I became a child expert on the mind-body problem. I used to imagine what it was like to order your wife's head chopped off or to be married to a man who had done that to his previous wife. I imagined being the executioner's child and the odd mood in the house at night when Dad came home from his job. I should say that I was good in school. I had friends. I played sports. Beheading was only part of what I thought about in my spare time. I was 11 or maybe 12 when I began to have a recurring dream. It began with me knocking on a door, always the same door, which was opened by a man, always the same kind, friendly, handsome man, who led me to the same room in which there was a chopping block, an axe, and a pyramid made from the heads of children. And I always understood that I was about to join them.
And now a writer whom I have admired for a long time and who came all the way from Germany to join us, Abraham Rodriguez.
Hi. I just want to say, first of all, thank you for this is just a fantastic thing, and to be amidst such writers and stuff is just a fantastic honor for me as a mid-list writer. I shouldn't have mentioned that. But it's just a fantastic honor, and to be in such a beautiful book, it's just fantastic. I wrote a story called Celebration, which is about a guy who, well, you know, I don't know if you guys work in offices, you know? I used to work in offices. I don't do that anymore. But I used to work in offices, and the thing about offices is that they have office parties. And when they have office parties, they play this music. And the music that they play is, well, you know, Sister Sledge, we are family. And this one song, Celebration Time. Celebration, come on. You know this song, Cool in the Gang? Yeah? Well, I hate this stuff. This just really drives me crazy. And I don't know what they're celebrating about. They're stuck in offices wearing suits, and there's this smell of fear because they're so scared of the boss. And all that. Okay, so I just figure, you know, this is a story about a guy who sort of goes psycho when he hears this song, and he has to just pummel somebody to death. And he tries to get away, and he tries to, okay? But he went through the door fast, and it wasn't the stairs. No stairs. It was a fucking men's room. And he slammed the door hard and hard again. It killed the music when he slammed it. It felt good to slam it. Slam it again. Just some sound beating in his head. Flash! The bright fluorescence. Flash! The mirrors over the pair of basins. Flash! The tiled wall. All of it blasting brightness at him. The door. He slammed it again and again. It was almost blotting out the noise. And maybe if he could keep that up, he could beat the noise. Because Myron said the best way to blot out the noise is with another noise, adding cryptically that this was the solution. And paradoxically, he used that word. Also, sometimes the problem. And that made M laugh in mid-slam. It was possible. He was doing it. He was going to beat it. He was going to beat it because they weren't going to get him. And that's when this guy came out of one of the stalls, looking mad as hell and somehow puffed up with all the authority his three-piece suit gave him. Hey, what the hell are you doing? It was a color thing and a sound thing, both at once. Now it was two marbles clacking together hard over and over again. It was wood breaking all sharp and crack. It was chicken bone splitting. It was the guy's skull splitting, cracking against the wall over and over. Whimpering cries, mad bursts of air, gurgled gasps. A body crumples down crash against the toilet and sets off to flush. Fresh water bursting spin with that muffled crash thump. At the last breath, the song changed. Thank you.
I so want to be him. You're getting an idea of what this book is like, but just the very, very little bit of how amazing it is and how amazing it's been for my co-editor, who I'm about to introduce. We decided to put ourselves in the lineup just a little. I didn't thank S.J. Roseanne, but she has been just the most wonderful, not just co-editor, but friend and who listens. She doesn't whine at all. I whine all the time. So, S.J. Roseanne.
I had been thinking a lot, and have been thinking a lot, about the Mongols. I have kind of the Mongols on my mind. So I went there. On your knees. The savage's words roared down with hopeless finality, recalling the thunder of the boulders that rolled from the breached walls of her father's city to lie mute and useless on the plain. Even now, after all these weeks in the barbarian kingdom, she comprehended little of what was said to her. But this phrase she understood, and understood as well the pain and penalty for disobedience. She knelt. He gazed, grinning, at her ivory skin and huge dark eyes. Her hair rippled like blue-black silk, glinting even in the sickly fluorescent light. Her pink nipples stood from her breasts, hardened not by desire, he knew, but by dread. Her fear inflamed him, and even more, her pride. He waited until he could barely stand it, so he could watch the beads of cold sweat form on her brow as she bent motionless before him. Then he barked the command. Flinching, she raised her slender hands, and slowly, the way he liked it, she worked his zipper down. He marveled at her movements, her control, steeling herself even against her own trembling. He could make her weep in pain, he had, but not from terror or despair, though he knew she felt both, felt them more powerfully every day. He'd never known a girl like this. He wondered how long it would take, what it would take, to break her. Oops, thank you. And now, the best co-editor there ever was.
I want you to imagine the year is 1956, and you're on the Long Island Railroad, and the story is called Ben and Andrea and Evelyn and Ben. And this is sort of how it starts. Ben drapes his sport jacket across his lap. His shirt is sticking to him, the train hot and airless, cigarette smoke, including his own, making it hard to breathe. There's a woman sitting across from him, his age, maybe a year or two younger, 31, 2, knees almost touching his, hair up in a French knot, stockings on her legs. Ben pictures clips and snaps as he watches her drag red lacquered fingernails along her collarbone, then play with a gold crucifix between the V of her breast and a wedding ring on her finger. She lifts her eyes from the newspaper, headline, Andrea Doria sinks off Nantucket, and they exchange a look. Ben crushes his cigarette into the tiny ashtray, and when the train hurtles underground and everything goes black, he leans forward, slides his hand up her leg and into her panties, and he hears her gasp over the sound of the rattling train tracks, and she opens her legs a bit wider. When the lights flash on, the woman drops the newspaper into her lap, and Ben slips his hand out as the train pulls into the station, and they exchange one last look before she gets up, adjusts her skirt, and disappears into the crowd. Outside, Ben can't remember how he got here.
See? He's irresistible. And finally, Ed White, who in fact, Amy was the second story in. Edmund White was the first story in, and I printed it out, and I read it on a train ride, and I couldn't believe, I was hysterical. I was laughing the whole ride. It's fabulous. So our final reader, and then we'll sign your books.
That's strange, because it wasn't meant to be funny. I have to warn you, this story, when I showed it to my friend Joyce Carol Oates, she said, I think this is one you might reconsider when you collect them. It's called The Creative Writing Murders. I never go anywhere without my iPod, which is usually rattling my teeth and every bone in my face. Today, I'm listening to great rage-filled yelps by Vivaldi, a soprano biting off words over rapid, stormy, descending passages played by massed violins. The whole thing is called In Furore Lustissimae Irae, which I couldn't translate, though I did 2 years of high school Latin in Catholic school 2 decades ago, and of course I speak Spanish. In a fury of lusty, very lusty anger, could it possibly mean that? That captures my mood, exactly. The 2 days a week I come out to Wilford College make me feel invisible and usually depressed. My undergrads seem profoundly incurious about me as a person, though a few of the senior boys check out my breast, but only covertly, never brazenly. The boys and girls are all hooking up with each other, even if no one ever courts anyone else. That must be why they drink so much. Their only seduction method is to fall in a big sodden pile every Saturday and thrash around until they pair off. In furore lustissima irae. Otherwise, the students are all obsessed by their homework and their infernal activities, because everyone here is expected to fence or row and work in a community literacy project and write editorials about Africa or Asia for the Will, as they call the weekly student paper. Everyone is busy, and most of them seem racked by obsessive compulsive disorders. Nancy wrote a story about a kid who counts all the letters of all the words spoken in her presence. The poor crazed kid's brain was just one quiet adding machine. When I asked on a sudden whim, how many other people in this room do this, count letters, 4 of the 12 students in the workshop raised their hands. Oh, yeah, and Kim, among the others, at least timidly raised her hand, too. I didn't say anything. Since I'm the only Hispanic woman in the department, my elderly white colleagues all prize me as if I were the last extant panda in a North American zoo. They would probably like me just as much if I were neurotic and resentful or frequently absent, or if I insisted on organizing 3-day Chicano festivals. But I'm not like that, which makes them even more grateful. I'm cheerful and prompt, and I've got a book that Copper Canyon has promised to publish if I can just finish 2 more stories. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. So that's a sample of what's in the book. I would love to read you the first pages of all the stories you didn't get to hear the first pages of, but, you know, you can get the book yourself and do that yourself. Thank you.